Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am thrilled to have in the studio with me this morning Brandon Lee. He is the author of a new book entitled Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing, a reflection on law enforcement community building workshops. It is a pleasure to have you here, Brandon.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joanne. Thanks so kindly for having me.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure. But I just jumped because I just so want to get into the conversation. So let me tell folks a little bit about your background.
Thank you.
Brandon J. Lee is co-founder and president of Training for Transformation, LLC. He is a proud black man born and raised in Oakland, California, with a lifetime of experience personally advocating for justice against profiling and institutional racism. He has become the expert in transforming traumatic circumstances into hopeful, victorious ones. He understands his understanding of how to correct and restore institutions to a healthy and inclusive environment is unmatched. Brandon is a regular presenter and speaker at colleges, universities, and conferences on topics that include Black Founding Fathers of the U.S., Community Conscious Policing, Black Male Achievement, English as a Second Language, and 21st Century Leadership. He is the author of the educational resource, Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing, released now. It's hot off the press. Brandon is also fluent in Spanish. He's lived, studied, and taught in Spain, Cuba, and Mexico. He's taught English as a second language for 5 years at universities both domestic and abroad to international students from around the world. And he brings a globally minded lens to locally focused situations. Brandon earned a BA in public policy and Spanish from Houston Baptist University and an MA in teaching from SIT, a School for International Training Graduate Institute. Okay, with that introduction, welcome to the studio, Brandon.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hardesty. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the introduction.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted people to know who I was talking to because you got some cred.
I've been working hard, no doubt.
Yeah, you have. What perfect timing this book is. So tell my listening audience, what exactly is community conscious policing?
Community conscious policing. So essentially, it's going to be a few components here, but let me just kind of give you the brief definition. It is a culturally competent, equitable, and empathetic approach to law enforcement based on 21st century conscious leadership principles.
And that is not, we don't normally hear the term empathy as we talk about policing and what our needs are around policing. And so why is that such an important component of creating the kind of policing force we want?
Certainly. So I'll take a step back. This could be, we're dealing with the topic of policing, but in general, I'm approaching it from leadership. So as a faculty member, I did teach English as a second language, but my focus was business English for international students seeking a BA or MBA. And so when we just look at kind of 21st century leadership, whatever your focus is, but particularly if your life depends on it. Mm-hmm. Empathy is going to be pretty much a skill centered on emotional intelligence to connect with those you're seeking to engage with. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we thought that cultural competency, equity, but definitely empathy should be that third pillar of 21st century conscious leadership.
Wonderful. And so timing's everything, huh?
It is most of it. Absolutely. A little hard work, but timing
right,
is most
right.
of it. Correct.
But having the right skill set at the right time in the right situation. And so you were working as a volunteer with the NAACP in Corvallis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at a time where policing was a bit, shall I say, out of control, like around the country, right? Not just in Corvallis, but people were gaining a heightened sense of awareness that something was wrong with policing in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the opportunity to do some really transformative work in Corvallis with Corvallis Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Let me share a little context. And I need to begin, hats off to Chief John Sassaman, their leadership there. Really, without their support, this process very well may not have taken place. So I want to take our hats off there. A little context of how it came up. I was serving as the legal redress chairman in NAACP Corvallis branch, and John Sassaman, the chief, happened to stop by. And basically, he brought the data that he had collected. So that's definitely a positive that they had been collecting stop data already, mm-hmm. doing pretty much above and beyond what was required
right.
Of them. And so he brought his data. He could tell pretty much quantitatively over a certain period of time that statistically they had pretty much eradicated mm-hmm. racial profiling as far as stops.
Mm.
But
well, let me just stop you for a sec. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
But I just want to take a moment to imagine a police chief uninvited, just kind of showing up with data in hand to an NAACP meeting saying, I want to show you my numbers on people we're stopping. I just have to take a moment for that, because that doesn't happen normally.
I was floored.
I'm glad you were floored too, because I just had to stop you, because it's like, that's not normal. That's not normally how police chiefs operate. So please continue.
Yes, certainly. So when he came, it was good to see. He didn't show up in uniform. Mm-hmm. He just came. I think the president, they probably had arranged it. But when he came, to be honest, you know, and we'll discuss a little bit about my past. But at that point, I was more of more skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Why would a police chief show up here with his data?
Right.
Does he need our stamp of approval? What is the angle here?
Right, right.
But it was nice to actually go through the data. And in that meeting, basically, I was able to share some of the work that we had done back in Oakland, the Citizens Police Review Board, some of the I was victorious in a police misconduct case in the past. And so it was a space for us to share kind of our experiences and what the quantitative data didn't show.
Mm-hmm.
And then insights that we had from campus working directly with students. And it was the chief, I have to give him credit, that after that meeting reached back out and said, who was that young man that was basically vetting?
right. Had all the questions, huh?
That was vetting me.
Right.
And how can we continue the conversation? So it was the chief reaching out to us through the local NAACP that kind of started this process.
Wow. And so what I love is that, so you had and you're right, because it does go back to leadership. So you had a police chief who thought he was doing a pretty decent job, was pretty proud of his data, but at least was aware that he could improve, right? So he didn't come like arrogant with, you know, yeah, well, we're not profiling anybody because the data proves it, right? Because we know data can prove anything you want data to prove.
And really, to give you even more of a context of how special that was, Corvallis PD, I don't know the exact poll, but I mean, they're ranked as one of the ideal places to work as a law enforcement officer in the country.
Wow.
So being they are CALEA accredited. So that basically is kind of the gold standard in public safety.
Right.
So he was beyond thinking I'm doing a good job.
Wow.
He had all the credibility to know he was doing a good job. But still, one of the things that we found doing the research for the book, we would like agencies to be or become self-monitoring,
mm-hmm.
Learning organizations
mm-hmm.
that will at some point be able to become self-correcting and
right.
proactive, right?
Right?
Getting ahead of the curve.
Right.
So when we talk about empathies and certain bullet points of what type of leadership can take an organization there,
right.
John Sassaman was hitting the checklist. Boom, 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 boom.
Wow.
Boom.
And so if you're just joining the conversation and you'd like to join us, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking to Brandon Lee. He is the author of Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing, a reflection on law enforcement community building workshops. And so what I know is that it is hard to have workshops with cops, right? It is hard to get them to, like, be real, right? And to leave that authoritarian, over-anxious mindset at the door. But you were able to do this in Corvallis and then also mm-hmm. for a much larger audience at a FBI training. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So essentially, you know, and I got it. There was a few bridges in between those trainings. But one in particular, once I did establish connecting with the chief and he reached back and wanted to continue the dialogue, I got a chance to meet Lieutenant Jim Zessen, mm-hmm. who is now the captain and will be retiring soon. But essentially, he was, I don't want to say dispatched, but came to see me in my office.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in plain clothes. And kind of just had a conversation about where we grew up,
mm-hmm.
And just engaged me kind of on a human connected level.
Mm-hmm.
And even though appearance wise, he might fit what we would call the dominant culture,
mm-hmm.
Through experiences, I was able to tell that he had some insights where he had experienced being the minority and kind of all the pressures that come with that. So
right.
there was some commonality there. When we did the training that we did in Corvallis happened to be the week of the verdict of the case in Ferguson, where it was going to be decided whether or not the officer was going to be charged or not.
Right.
So, of course, the current events at that time was stakes were high. Everybody and really the motivation and inspiration was as a teacher and administrator, my students' grades were becoming impacted.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't spaces for them to be able to outlet, build, share, cry. And so from that, that's what we wanted to create. We didn't see anything else being done to provide that space. Essentially, we did a great job. And when I mean a great job, that doesn't mean it was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that we pulled it off, number one.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, it was really key that when there was protesting and when folks did want to come out and express themselves because they might not have found out about our space.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to the Corvallis PD because we had just done this the week before
right.
with that verdict.
Right.
The NAACP could come out along with the Corvallis Masons. You mm-hmm. have predominantly black folks, predominantly dominant culture in the Corvallis Masons. But together we can say, listen,
mm-hmm.
we just had a conversation with right. our local police department.
Right.
This isn't the place.
Right, right.
And
we're not having that problem. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So it was out of that the FBI National Academy Associates and hats off to David Hensley, who I had met through Corvallis PD and basically had experienced our training during that heightened sense of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so for their annual spring training, they thought that Training for Transformation and our style was what was needed.
Mm-hmm.
And really, quite honestly, at the time and even now, there just wasn't any alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so they reached out to see how we could work together and do a statewide training for them.
Wonderful. And so how many participants were in that training?
So the statewide training consisted of probably 70 to 80 law enforcement leaders
mm-hmm.
around the state,
mm-hmm.
roughly 50 to 60 community members.
Mm-hmm.
Even the FBI National Academy Associates assisted in turnout. And it was just an unprecedented event. And hats off to Dave Hensley and the Oregon chapter for the FBI National Academy Associates, because just like in Corvallis, they were the ones that initiated
mm-hmm.
to see how we could come together. So, you know, even with the focus of the book being best practices in community conscious policing, when everything is negative and there's murder on TV,
mm-hmm.
cameras, and you just can't get away from it. It was more of how do we find a lens to see what is working,
mm-hmm.
who's doing it. It may not be perfect, but
right.
what can we bring together for a statewide conversation?
That was fabulous. So if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Now, it's really interesting to me that that your team took a grassroots approach to engaging community members.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't go to like the top organizations or the top nonprofits and say, send your leader to this event. You actually went and got grassroots folks, the ones that would be more likely to experience policing in a negative light. And had them participate. How were you able to create that space
mm-hmm.
for both the police and for folks who I suspect didn't have a lot of trust in the police to be in the same room and to be able to get something out of participating in this event?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So in regard to community engagement, probably the scope, and that really was in my field. My business partner was on more on the curriculum side. But in terms of community outreach, again, the lens that this work, that we approach our work. So personally, you might have heard of a book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially, that book was documenting experiences in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was during the time period when I was growing up,
mm-hmm.
right? There was no end to racial profiling bill
mm-hmm.
back then. I mean, there was battering rams. I mean, this is even before Rodney King, or
right.
at least during that time.
Right.
So the way that I approached community engagement was as a survivor myself, mm-hmm. right? I mean, writing my book, I don't focus on it, but I was dealing with my own racial profiling cases mm-hmm. while writing the book, but trying wow. to keep a positive lens. So
right.
I knew then as a survivor who, know what it's like to not have the leaders, quote unquote, in the community to be there when you need them. Mm-hmm. We didn't want representatives. We wanted some real authentic voices. So that's from my experience engaging in the community, mm-hmm. houseless communities, respectfully students that I've had to engage with, mm-hmm. regardless if it was their class, NAACP Legal Redress Chairman. We even extended working with dominant culture, white students in rural areas mm-hmm. that may not have advocacy.
Right.
So really, it was a drawn upon experiences that brought me here from the agitator to kind of advocate that mm-hmm. I want to go back into those spaces mm-hmm. and bring folks to come and actually share their authentic experiences directly with those that were empowered to make some significant changes.
Right, right. Again, I am talking with author Brandon Lee. His new book, Best Practices in Community Conscious Placing, is available. And he also has a website. And the website is, I'm going to pull that right up. TrainForTransformation.com is the website for more information. I love your approach to working with police, because it is my belief that until we can get more community members involved in training police to be effective community police officers, we will continue to have this military mindset. We'll continue to create this us versus them mentality, because if you don't actually have to see people as human, then you don't have to be empathetic. You don't have to have any kind of understanding of their circumstance or why they're in the position that they're in. So I think the book is really timely, and I think it's absolutely critical as we think about policing wherever we're thinking about it. I know in Portland, we have a mayor and a police chief that are adamant that we need more police officers, mm-hmm. and the public doesn't know if that's true. Because what we know is that there are a lot of specialty units within Portland Police that aren't on patrol that could be. Mm. What we know is that there are a lot of police officers in schools, starting at elementary schools all the way up to high schools, that shouldn't be in schools. They should actually be on the street patrolling the neighborhoods, right? And so there's no way for the public to do any kind of analysis. We're right in the smack in the middle of budget season, right? So all the rhetoric is running high and loud. We have a mayor who's raising the alarm. Unless we pass this business tax, we can't fund policing. We can't fund homeless services. And so the public is left to wonder whether or not this, alarm that's been sound is real, or is it just the normal budget alarms that are sound whenever the police want more money in their budget and don't want to go through the regular budget process that every other department goes through?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're at that place here in Portland mm-hmm. now. And I wish we had gone through a process like you did in Corvallis prior to the budget season, because guess what? If the community went with the police chief and said, we've done our own analysis, we understand that there is a big vacuum and we need to do X, Y, Z, that would make a much more compelling case than just the mayor and the police chief. Because, mm-hmm. I got to tell you, the gang enforcement unit, when 10 officers stop one person, to me, that's a waste of resources. It is absolutely not necessary to have 10 police officers to stop one or two people on the street. But that's how their unit rolls. We have a caller on the line. Good morning, Sunny. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for the show, as always, Joanne. And I think you two are two very important components to help with the present picture of the country, because you're talking about important considerations always, Joanne, and everything.
Well, thank you.
Giving us lots to think about always. And this fellow is talking about cohesion between the police and the people. And at this time, we've got Trump possibly coming right over the horizon. And let's remember, he took the the, what do you call it, when, well, David Duke, KKK, said, we like Trump. Trump said, that's okay, I kind of like you.
Yeah, well, he had to think about whether or not he needed to disavow him, right? The first thing he ever had to think about. Things that make you go,
the first. And then now we have a white nationalist who's shown up, and then the Nazis are prowling around in the background. And then we know, additionally, that the potential for voter fraud through the voting machines is there.
It's enormous, yes.
And then, on top of it, if he really does lose the election and his people feel that, no, he didn't lose the election, we've got more trouble coming up behind there. So that the time for unification amongst all the good-hearted people who believe in freedom, as far as the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the foundation of structure in this country, our hearts all together across colors, across races, across religion or non-religion or class is so important, what you're saying right here, right now. We've got to get it together right now and show that we really are one people, because these people are going to try something.
Yes, thank
you. And they're working it. They're working it right now, actually. So the good cops are so important in all of this effort. They're extremely primary, and the people unifying together. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sunny. Really appreciate the call and your wisdom as always.
Have
a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Brandon, did you want to comment on anything that you heard?
Sure. So I appreciate the local insights here. So, you know, you brought up some things, a couple of points of why we wanted to focus on the aspect of consciousness and community policing. You know, our slogan is to humanize our collective experiences and to bring others together who may otherwise remain at a perpetual distance. Mm-hmm. The humanize our collective experiences actually came from Lieutenant Jim Sesson, who allowed us to borrow that as a part of our slogan. So that came from a police officer.
Wow.
And so, you know, one of the parts, you know, we're not here to kind of get in between the lines of, you know, are police good or are they bad? Mm-hmm. We really make an effort to look at police as a part of the community and as indicators of where we are in the community, mm-hmm. right? So we try to focus on concepts of reconciliation. Mm. Where are the spaces where we can heal?
Yes.
Where are the spaces where we can learn from one another? Mm. So if you came to one of our workshops, you would find, you know, there are some privilege oppression exercises. But, you know, what was interesting, we set it up for community and law enforcement to bond, basically, or reestablish other spaces to connect. But when we left, there were actually officers that didn't know one another as well. And were able to reestablish people that worked together 15, 20 years, but didn't know that they had similarities in the past or they connected. So, you know, an example, we had a Muslim student who had been targeted, a woman who had been targeted on campus. And she would share, you know, basically the decision she would have to go through, whether or not to wear her hijab or not, and what it would take for her to get to class from home.
Right.
And she ended up walking miles because of how she would be treated on the bus or... we heard from a law enforcement ticket. She does parking.
Right.
In the
enforcement.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And so to hear her experiences walking around the community every day, issuing tickets. Mm-hmm. And so here we're listening to our Muslim student, right?
Right.
And her experience.
Right.
And then this parking attendant on a daily basis who certainly is qualified to handle herself.
Right, right.
But the kind of the nuances
right.
that crossed and then how they were able to actually find a connection.
Mm-hmm.
But had they not had a space,
right.
right, they wouldn't have been able to. So these are, there are elements regards to community outreach. We did not use social media. We wanted to be person to person, and the focus being on conflict transformation. The final thing that I'll say here is that my background is in teaching, but my business partner, her background is conflict transformation there at the School for International Training, where we both attended. So she focused on genocides.
Mm-hmm.
How do you bring together communities that might have experienced something like in Rwanda?
Right.
And now I still got the oppressor and the oppressed still
right.
in the same place.
That's
and
right.
how do we? So there are skills from an international lens that we're able to bring to locally focused situations to kind of help mediate and come to a shared consensus.
Well, I love your reconciliation component, because I think it's been the biggest challenge in Portland Police Bureau has been that Portland Police want to jump to reconciliation, but they want to skip over the truth part, right? And you can't actually get to reconciliation without truth. I have conversations all the time with Portland police officer. Well, we want to start from today building relationships. Well, you have a traumatized community that has suffered harm at your hands, and you have to actually acknowledge that that exists before you can go anywhere, right? And so that's been the biggest challenge at trying to move Portland police, because, of course, they do nothing wrong. So if you don't do anything wrong, then you don't have anything to apologize for. And so let's just start building relations today. It sounds like a very very thoughtful approach, and I love having that your partner's experience, because it absolutely plays in the policing, right? Because where do we recruit police officers from? We recruit them from the military. We recruit them from war-torn areas. We recruit them from some of the worst conditions in society, and somehow we expect that they're going to come in and they're all of a sudden going to have the skill set to be effective community police officers, right? Now, if you want somebody to go fight a war, you have a different criteria than you do for someone that you want to be able to engage people where they are in a local community. And we're going to go back to the phone line. Do we have a caller? Excellent. Camilo, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Good morning. This discussion really appealed me because it engages principles that have become very important in my experience. I began a Buddhist meditation practice about 10 weeks ago, and it sounds like the principles of the training really incorporate some basic Buddhist concepts, the idea of trying to share the basic human values between people who have different perspectives is something that Buddhism meditation can accomplish. And I participated in some contemplative group dynamic workshops that show the potential for this. And an illustration is a friend of mine who works in the prisons doing Buddhist meditations with both the guards and the prisoners, and has shown how remarkable changes can come about. And I think that this is something to consider. I'm not an expert on it. I'm just a novice. But I recognize the great potential that it has for reaching out and making a difference.
Me too. And I'm hoping that that this is something that can actually become just kind of institutionalized at the state level. And it's kind of ironic to say institutionalized, right? Because what we're trying to do is de-institutionalize the men and women who work in that environment. But I think to make it standard across the board so that anybody in law enforcement comes in with that kind of training and mindset.
Well, one of the basic principles is that one begins by looking for basic goodness in him or herself.
Right.
And this really requires having compassion for yourself.
Yes.
And it's only with achieving that can you find compassion for others.
Well, thank you so
eloquently
much.
Eloquently stated.
Yes, we couldn't have said it any better ourselves. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, appreciate the call.
Okay.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I am talking to author Brandon Lee, Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing. I don't know if you know Ron Louie. Ron Louie is a former sheriff of Washington County Sheriff's Department, and he is retired, but he's an instructor both at PCC Cascade as well as at University of not the university the one in North Portland, University of Portland, in North Portland. He teaches law enforcement there. But when he was a police chief, when he was a sheriff at Washington County, he had his officers do several things. One, his officers were really trained in how to de-escalate situations on the street. They had people that, had it been in Portland, they would have been killed. But they were, people were disarmed, taken to mental health hospitals where they were able to get treatment because of the very specific training that they received as a mandate from the top.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that he did was allow his officers to participate in yoga because he had this belief that if the mind and body were in sync, people would be less likely to resort to weaponry if, in fact, their mind and body was in sync. They would be more likely to be able to talk their way out of any situation they encountered.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's just been this, this fascinating model of a leader who was willing to try anything to make sure that his officers were responsive to the people that they were serving. You don't see that often in policing. And so I would I'd encourage you to find him.
Yes, I will take you up on that.
Google him.
Yep.
And he's just a wonderful man. He's just like really, he walks his talk. And so there are models. Normally when people tell me, well, you know, the good police officers need to, I normally say if they were good police officers, they would actually stand up when they see constitutional rights being abused and violated. They would actually turn in other officers who they saw committing those kind of crimes. They would not be silent. There would not be this blue wall of silence if they were good police officers. So that's just me. And I know you have a different perspective about that. So I'd like to hear what that would be.
Sure, sure. And, you know, the caller really kind of hit things dead on the nail. Just for, you know, kind of access to our message, we try to kind of steer clear of religious, right, coining. But in terms of the aspect of the conscious space, and that's exactly why we inserted it between community and policing, because we saw a lot of departments that wanted to go immediately into, let's go talk to the community.
Right.
And to be fair, right, I mean, there's tools and skills, especially if you're in a space where the community shifts every 10 years or is brand new with residents that you aren't aware of before, right? So there's some tools and some skills necessary to engage.
Right.
But in terms of the conscious space, our workshops begin with the concept of interbeing. So interbeing would really look at where are we connected as a human body, as a human family, and then focus on those. And then, so for example, if we take this kind of religious conversation and just look at it in terms of leadership, then we would be, say, let's maybe Daniel Pink, who authored A Whole New Mind and was talking about how our left brain, and I'm no brain scientist, so please, this is what he said, his research. But essentially, left brain processing or the kind of the 80s and 90s way of doing things, Excel spreadsheets, right, is how do we dissect what's in front of us and analyze, you know, the components individually to come up with our narrative or our truth.
Right.
21st century is more holistic, and that's exactly what you're saying with the difference of approach. Well, let's start today. Well, that's a very linear way to say I want to start on this particular moment,
right?
Whereas we're saying, wait, hold on. Before, I've been here four or five generations.
That's right.
Before I even got involved, I saw this with my grandparents. I saw it with my aunts and my uncles. Then I started to go through it. So we can't just
start from here.
We can't just start from here. So one of the things that we it's not just about race, but also about leadership principles. And there's just a new rubric by which institutions are being measured.
Yeah.
A lot more complex.
We're going to go back to the phones. Martin. Good morning, Martin. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. I listen a lot. This is the first time I've called in.
Oh, well, thank you for calling.
Oh, no, absolutely. So I'm just coming at it with a little bit of a different perspective. I've had a longstanding belief that sort of a traditional policing model may not be effective or may not actually be possible in a sort of genuine sense of looking after the community.
Right.
There's just, it's not that there aren't good cops, cops being like the individuals who decide to take up a badge or patrol the streets or work in the community that way with good intent. but that it's, and you guys have talked about this, but it's inherently a, this, it's a system that promotes institutional racism through sort of this, and acts of violence and with a lack of accountability just through these, through this sort of brotherhood, sisterhood of backing each other up. It's this community aspect that they've created, but their community doesn't extend to the greater community of people living in a given area. It's a community within themselves, so they make themselves an island where they
right.
have to look out for each other.
Right.
There have been, I know there have been these test community policing neighborhoods done in New York and I think in a few other cities where community leaders and, prominent members of the community or people who are really interested in helping work with local businesses and local establishments to help police neighborhoods by having the community be accountable. And I feel like that's the most accurate or the most detailed example of having police look like your community is that your community is actually your police.
Yes, yes. That's an excellent, right. I like that. That is an excellent way to put that. Thank you so much. Appreciate the call.
Yeah,
appreciate you listening.
Thank you.
And now you're over that hump, so now you can call anytime.
Can I chime in on that?
Yes, please.
You know, there was an example. The day before, number one caller, thank you for the insights. This is in direct response to what you shared with us. So when I was basically the day before I attended graduate school, I ordered a pizza. pizza delivery guy brought my pizza. Ate it, enjoyed it so much that I fell asleep, took
right.
a nap right there on the spot, right?
Uh-oh, right.
I wake up from my nap, I go outside, I walk past, and I see out the window the pizza delivery car is still there.
Right.
So I'm at home with my grandparents. I'm getting ready to go to grad school. It's a big deal. So I'm the only one home. And I go outside and let them know, sorry, it's my grandparents. They're going to be
right.
home soon. I'm going
right.
to need you to go.
Right. Why are you still here?
Why are you
right.
still here?
Right.
And I probably was even a little rude about it. Young man, probably in high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
Young African-American man. And he's so apologetic. I'm sorry. I locked my keys in the car.
Ah.
And he's been trying desperately to get out of there
right.
for a while now.
Right.
I feel bad. I go inside and I only have shorts and a t-shirt on. I run outside. Now I'm trying to help the guy because
right,
I feel
right.
bad. And,
so two black men trying to break into a car. I can see where this is going. Go ahead.
Here comes three. Of Oakland Police Department's finest.
Right, right.
Right? Now, when they come, make a long story short, essentially, when they come, I say, oh, help has arrived.
Right, right.
This means that I can now go in the house,
right?
right my
right.
job is done.
It's all good, right?
Police step out. Oh, sir, here's the officer. Here's the car, owner of the car. Hey,
right.
Thanks a lot for stopping by. And I start to head to the house.
Right.
Sir, do you mind stepping aside? Can you? Turn around, put your hands behind there. I'm so, I can't believe what's going on, right?
Right, right.
And
right.
so I let the officer know that from this point moving forward that whatever he did needed to be by the book,
right?
right? Because I'm already planning my redress.
Right, right.
So make a long story short, I got out of that situation. Luckily, a neighbor 2 or 3 hours later finally came outside and let them know that this was enough, that they needed to let me out. And it was, they were tired of having the cops on the street, right? I'm in front of $1 million house
right.
and I got a $70,000 Cadillac on the driveway, but I'm breaking into this guy's pizza.
Right,
he's got
right.
on the pizza shirt.
Right,
he's got
right.
on the red pizza box. And you can see the keys inside the car, but it's taken him 3 hours to investigate, trying
right.
to enter my home, all kind of things,
wow.
right? Luckily, I was aware of my rights.
Right.
So make a long story short, this became the catalyst that Pueblo, a local organization, and ACLU San Francisco each collaborated, and we were able to use this as a catalyst. Took 2 or 3 years, but kind of were able to establish the Citizens Police Review Board out of this case, right? So it's an example of how one case can be used as a tipping point to
yes.
kind of get the resolutions that the community desires.
Yes.
I went back home maybe 6 months ago to Oakland, same neighborhood.
Right.
They have completely transformed at least my immediate area.
Oh.
There is an immediate neighborhood watch that meets regularly. When I showed up, it was packed.
Wow.
The officer, there was only one or two, but the officers there might not have known everybody by name,
right.
but knew everybody's story.
Wow.
Gave everybody an update on their individual cases, whether it was against law enforcement or what was going on in their community, the crime they had reported.
Wow.
And so now, as the caller mentioned, right, we all are on Facebook.
Right. Right. That's right.
We, the officers, the community, and
right.
now we all, so when there's an alert, we get the alert.
Wow.
Right? And so now we're working as a team. So when I shared who I was, what I had been through,
right.
everybody looked at me like, what?
Right.
Here?
Right.
And so it's an example of how we can go from this space of being profiled and dealing with the, you know, if I didn't act smart, that could have been dangerous for me, right?
Absolutely.
All the way to this space to where, at least in my neighborhood, right, it's actually community conscious.
Wow.
And we're building and sharing with one another.
So we're going to get back to the issue of community oversight of policing, because we are in desperate need of that here in Portland. I'm going to let you know what's coming up on Naboo today. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints. Boy, I got my tongue stuck this morning. Flashpoint features the weekly Flashpoints election protection section with Greg Palast talking about voter suppression, who is the expert on America's voter suppression, I might add. Want to thank our KBOO members for your support and our recent successful membership drive. If you missed it, you can always go online at kboo.fm and become a member there. We want to thank you very much for that, and we do want to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Derek. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful conversation, and your guest is extremely impressive in everything he's been doing.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
I'm thrilled to have him, yes.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted to ask if a technology, I think of it as a communication technology called nonviolent communication, which seems to be an incredible way to resolve conflicts and so on, interpersonally, internationally, you name it. I just wondered if that was, had informed your methods at all, or if you consider those what you do related to the NVC, nonviolent communication systems.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that question. What a great question.
No, it's an incredible question, right? And so to answer, what we tried to do, so the quick answer is no. I didn't borrow directly from the nonviolent communication. However, just as you mentioned, the caller who is going through his journey in Buddhism, you'll probably find that we have looked for virtues, values, universal laws, principles that probably are very common in native indigenous cultures, communities,
right.
And then also kind of the basis that mainstream or current data and scholars kind of glean from. And so by the time it gets to us, it might have a new cool name or a new expert. But essentially, it's just kind of retelling the same story. And so it's very possible from the Buddhist perspective and nonviolent communication perspective. I mean, an example that I have was growing up in Oakland, you kind of had to, at least my neighborhood, I grew up in the Hill in Oakland. Oakland isn't all bad. I went to private school, so let me be clear.
Right.
But there are spaces where I had to go, whether my family or whoever. If you knew the right person right on the street, you might have an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if you knew the right person to call, that one person could settle any differences in that particular area, right? And so that's kind of an example of the nonviolent communication that at least related to our work, is relationship-based, right? If community, if law enforcement is a part of the community or has it has the ability to engage, learn from, and share, then yes, ideally, we would like to think that community-conscious policing would most certainly add to reducing violence, to reducing liabilities, to building building communal trust, and overall optimizing performance and reducing waste. We're careful not to make certain claims or guarantees, but ideally, I think the nonviolent communication and what we're doing probably gleaned from some of the same principles and definitely leads to the same results, I would imagine.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you so much, caller.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Thanks
You're
so
welcome.
Much, sir.
Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I am talking to Brandon Lee. He is the author of Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing, a reflection on law enforcement community building workshops. Now, you talked a little about putting together the community oversight process in Oakland. Tell me what Oakland has now that it didn't have prior to that.
Yes.
As far as oversight of police.
Sure. So, again, I want to give honor and praise. There was a communal effort for, and just like here in Portland, right? I mean, there are generations and folks that came before me that I stand on their shoulders,
right?
So it was, I just happened to be kind of at the tipping point. Mm-hmm. But essentially, like I mentioned, during that time, there was no end of racial profiling bill. We had to basically catalog any practice or pattern or practice of bias that we felt we had to prove it.
Right.
Quantitatively, qualitatively. That's pretty much where we began. Now, Pueblo, the local organization, Reseda Grenache, her husband was actually a white woman, but her husband was disabled and killed some years ago by OPD that got her inspired to do the work. So there were local organizations already on the ground.
Right.
At the time, I was in grad school, basically writing letters and fighting my case. And then I was able to connect with ACLU, who brought a legal perspective to what I went through.
Mm-hmm.
And then so when I combined the community trench work that mm-hmm. had been going on,
right.
the American Civil Liberties component that provided the legal mm-hmm. Authority.
Right.
And then essentially the movement at that time needed, and this is with all due respect, but needed kind of a Rosa Parks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of folks that might have had some past issues or issues that prevented them from being the spokesperson.
Right. Or from being the model claimant, right?
And,
yes,
you know,
yes.
I have different opinions about that because
as
I think,
did Michelle Alexander.
Oh my
she
gosh.
Finally came to light, right?
And yes. she wasn't. I mean, there was a lot of folks in that generation that just didn't believe it could be that bad.
That's right. That's right.
But essentially, when I came and I'm from grad school, you know, knock on wood, I have no criminal record. And my message was pretty clear, mm-hmm. right? I came in to give the testimony mm-hmm. before the city council. And so the question was, well, we don't have money. We need this and that. And so we were able to prove my case kind of being the catalyst that our independent review system through internal affairs was not producing the results.
Right.
Particularly, I had once something very similar in Berkeley.
Ah.
So it was like, how come I in Berkeley, California, right over here, similar thing happens
right.
and I get a successful. Well, they have a track record and a strong internal review process. Right.
Uh-huh.
But over here, we proved that it was ineffective.
Right.
So we need to take that $1 million budget and we need to reapply it and provide the citizens with the tools, or excuse me, the residents with the tools
right.
to be able to hold police accountable themselves.
And so tell me about that process. So there's a how many member board and what are their powers? And
Sure. And I have to begin with the preface. So we're going through the process now in Portland.
Okay.
This establishing a citizen oversight accountability board,
oh.
right? But in Oakland, this was probably 2010, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those details, they're just not fresh on my memory. So I don't want to try to. But what I will say is that having gone through that process and looking back,
right.
It's not the end all be all.
Right.
There are some recommendations that we glean, you know, the right for subpoena power,
mm-hmm.
You know, funding possibilities. You have maybe police presence that are paid. You have community members that are not. Who does the work. And
right.
I mean, so it's not the end all be all, but it was a step in the right direction. And it's something that you have to remain vigilant on
right.
about.
Right.
If you do get it established, it's something that you have to maintain
right.
Vigilant for it to remain effective.
Well, I will definitely do some homework to look at that because we, in fact, are not. We think we have a police oversight system, right? We have what's called the IPR, which is the Independent Police Review Division, which is a program of the Portland City Auditor's Office. But it doesn't actually investigate police. It actually isn't independent of police. In fact, it throws out 74% of every complaint that walks in its door. And so that's the pretend accountability system that's in place in Portland. And it's a very frustrating system, both for community members and it should be for police who actually want other police officers held accountable for inappropriate behavior and activity. And so we're not even close to having a system that the public could trust and that would be considered fair and equitable. I mean, we keep adding people to the IAD, which is the Internal Affairs Division. However, they continue to do less and less investigations. So it makes the public wonder. So the Department of Justice said they needed more investigators. But for what? Because they're investing less and less police officers that they're supposed to be. So it's a So what we have is ineffective, inefficient, and I would say criminal to some extent, because it does just the opposite of what an accountability system should do.
You know, and so coming out of Oakland during the 80s and right. the 90s, right. Going to college, I was in East Texas and right. have seen quite a bit. You know, if I was to kind of share my own personal story, mm-hmm. I often tell folks that it probably a lot of people lose hope if I was to share what I've endured.
All your
and,
life, right?
Yeah. So it was really important on how to where's the hope in a space where yes. you have a system. So, for example, right, I'm aware I've done the research of the Oregon exclusion laws. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the historical basis of a lot of the state based yes. discrimination that. Yes. I mean, it's Oregon, but it's something wherever you are in some way, shape, or form, you're either benefiting from it or kind of enduring
that's,
it, right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
It's exactly why I went and I did a talk, and we offer it now, but it's, we did it for Black History Month, Black Founding Fathers of the United States of America.
Uh-huh.
And so someone like me, right, I'm fourth out of fifth doctoral student.
Right.
My mom, 4 degrees out of Berkeley, both my grandparents, one has advanced degrees, both college educated.
Right.
My oldest, my sister, cousin.
So that's the legacy of your family,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so coming from my family, you know, I grew up with my grandparents,
right.
so the torch was given directly to me.
Right.
So if you start on the first census in 1790, I mean, I believe it, and don't get me wrong, but I think there was around 60,000 free, what they call colored persons
right.
back then, right?
That's right?
And so there's this narrative of, with all that's against us,
mm-hmm.
well, how do we do it so well for so long?
Right.
And so once we kind of looked at, you know, staking our claim, of course, honoring the ancestors, honoring where we're from,
right.
but also making claim to what we established here, then the attitude kind of shifts to what I like to call can-do statements. So in my classroom, my students can only use can-do statements.
Uh-huh.
There's plenty we can't do, right?
Well,
what can you do?
Right.
And so one of them from the legal redress was, well, we need to train community. Number one, on where to file complaints,
right?
How to advocate for themselves.
Right.
And so through that process of building the capacity with community members,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times even that helped relations because mm-hmm. there was now more of an alignment in terms of how officers saw a situation and
yes.
community members could understand where they were coming from, even if the officers might not have had the holistic context of this person and their experiences, et cetera.
Right.
And let's see. Oh. And I wanted to just touch on, you asked about kind of the basis of the Citizens Police Review Board. And I did want to give you a couple of nuggets.
Okay.
It was based on Kamala Harris,
uh-huh.
Attorney General, and from Oakland. Shout out. But she was prosecutor in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I believe it was a San Francisco model of Citizens Police Review Board
okay.
That it was modeled after.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of the, she might check out kind of how they did things in San Francisco. And that was the model that we based ours off of.
Wonderful. I do think that there is some opportunity. There's lots of opportunities. I mean, this is kind of a fertile ground. But I think the point that you have reiterated over and over again is what it really takes is leadership from the top, right? You have to have a police chief who actually is willing to be transparent and open in order to make this kind of transformation happen, because it's not just tinkering around the edges. It's about a new way of thinking about how policing is done and how you partner with the community to make that happen. Brandon, it's been such a pleasure having you on the program today. You will definitely be back because we're going to be talking
Absolutely.
About a whole bunch of other stuff.
Absolutely.
Again, the book is Best Practices in Community Conscious Policing, a reflection on law enforcement, community building workshops by Training for Transformation. Brandon Lee, it's available now on
trainfortransformation.com and all major outlets.
Thank
you for having me.
It has been my absolute pleasure. And so we've got your website. Anything coming up that you want to do a shout out for that you can think of?
There will be so much. Just stay tuned. Trainfortransformation.com. We will be doing around the city, and we'll begin doing some traveling in the fall. So stay tuned.
Wonderful. Well, we will definitely check out the website. I will not be here next week. Actually, Brandon and I will be in Salem talking to...
Talking to the Oregon LECC. And for those who don't know, is the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee. And so basically we are charged with helping community members file complaints if they feel as though they have been racially profiled against. So please look up the Oregon LECC through Portland State University, and we would love to assist you learn more from you.
Yeah, and that's new. That was since the last legislative session due to the passage of the Racial Profiling Act bill. Now there is actually a depository in Salem that is collecting that data from every law enforcement agency around the state. And my understanding is that it's not a mandate, right? They voluntarily, so it's like we're not mandating that every agency does it, but those that do collect the data are required to submit it to...
And we're probably we're actually working through that process now. But most importantly, what I would like community to know is that it's an independent body. If you do not want to deal directly with the directly with the entity that you might have an issue with, you can come here through a community member. Salome Chimq is doing an incredible work over there, and so definitely just do some more work, and you can find us online.
Excellent. Well, I will see you not next week, but the week after. You have an absolutely fabulous day. I am Joanne Hardesty. This has been Voices from the Edge. Thank you, Steve, for being a fabulous engineer. See you guys in 2 weeks. Have a great day.
Thank
Bye.
You.